If you're a regular listener to the Business News Hour, you know that our long-form interviews usually run between 15 and 20 minutes. But when we go out to lunch, we like to linger a while. Here's the setup. Each week, I take an interesting thought leader out to lunch. We talk over our business lunch, and you get to listen in. And today, my lunch partner is Heidi Soliday, the first female sports director in television. And wow, wow, has she got the stories. Settle back and listen in as we go out to lunch with Heidi at the Range Grill and Golf here in the Des Moines Metro.
Insight on Business, the News Hour, is made possible through the support of Aurion HR, Human Resource Management, so you don't have to, AurionHR.com, and the National Tractor Parts Dealer Association, whose members serve the ag community with new and used parts, NTPDA.com.
Welcome back to the Business News Hour. We are out to lunch at the Range Grill and Golf with Heidi Soliday. Heidi Soliday, of course, a former sports director at the CBS affiliate in Des Moines, Iowa, at KCCI. Heidi, welcome to lunch.
Hey, it's been a blast so far.
Wow.
I can't believe you might have to edit this down. I have a tendency to yap, but I think you know
you
that.
You yap well. you yap well. Well, Heidi and I, we worked together not too very long ago. We were doing the Bike World thing, and which was really fun. It was a ladies' social.
Ladies' bike social, yep.
Yeah, it was great fun.
And I think we were a little too irreverent sometimes, but hey.
But it was good. It was good. So I want to start with you and tell this story, because you come from a large family. We learned that in quick bites. And you've always been a competitive nature. You were also named the first female sports director at a TV station in the United States, which I, you know, today you go, really? Really? But there aren't many women in the area of sports, is that something that's happening?
I kind of get the sense that there's a few more women in sports locally than there used to be. But look around here in Des Moines. I mean, who's on in sports? Do you know of any women that are doing sports and television in Des Moines? Or for that matter, on the radio. If they're doing sports on the radio, they're probably doing play-by-play or color for women's basketball.
Right.
There's a few women in the radio that have worked at sports stations before or have worked on television in sports, but I don't know of any. I mean, I don't know. I think just recently one of the stations here in Des Moines had a woman covering the Iowa women's basketball team when they were going to try to make the Final Four. But I don't know if she's a sports reporter or a female news reporter that
got
they
picked.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just don't think there's a ton. But I do think there's nationally you see a lot of women out there doing sideline stuff. And I'll tell you one thing I do get asked still, which is funny because it was asked back then when I was doing my thing, and that is just the attire that women wear when they're being sideline reporters. Like, what do I think? A lot of times I have friends text me, did you see what this girl was wearing? Which
really?
I think that some women find it kind of irritating that women who are sideline reporters tend to wear not a lot of clothing, you know, short skirts or sleeveless tops or low-cut tops or, I don't know, just something like that. And what do I think? In general, I think there's a lot of that on air, too. I mean, I see women wearing sleeveless dresses during the winter on air. It seems kind of crazy to me. I guess my attitude would be, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'd be wanting to run around showing a lot of cleavage when I'm covering some sporting events, although, in a way, you might get
You might get the interview. Yeah.
And if that's how you're going to get the interview, what up with that, right?
Wow.
That's a whole... I'm opening a lot of...
You are.
Compacts, makeup compacts here. But, I mean, it's true, though. I mean, I don't think you should necessarily have a dress code, but I don't know if you should be hanging out
right.
in a professional setting.
Heidi Soliday, ladies and gentlemen, not one to mince words. we just started. Whoa. Wow. When you got into sports, and I want to peel back the onion just a little bit, but come up more recently. When you were the sports director at the CBS affiliate in Des Moines, what was that? That's kind of a lonely position in a sense, because you're kind of the one-man band out there. I mean, they would send you, and you had to do whatever you had to do and do the interviews and write your own stories, whereas other folks may or may not have. How did that role of a sports broadcaster change from the time that you started until the time that you ended? What changes were there?
For sure, the one-man band thing was a little different for a while. I think that people do a lot of one-man banding now simply because the equipment is so much smaller.
Oh, sure.
I mean, you could do a story on your phone. Or I've seen people out doing a story. They might have a photographer with them, but they're also shooting stuff maybe with a tablet or something like that. But the one-man banding thing was very frequent a long time ago, and this was with big equipment. So that was, you know, you might be carrying a tripod, a big heavy tripod, a tape deck, a camera, a battery belt, blah, blah, blah. But I was tough, I guess you could say. I mean, I have a lot of brothers, and if anybody was going to do something like that, it would be me, because I didn't really take a lot of guff from anybody. I mean, I just didn't. And I might have not been the most debonair
demure person.
No, never like demure, but maybe I didn't use a lot of tact a lot. A story comes to mind about this. Early on, when we first started doing satellite coverage, satellite trucks and stuff like that, we didn't have a satellite truck right away, but you could... I remember trying to find places where somebody might have a way to send video satellite, and then you could pull it down. Well, the year that the University of Iowa basketball team almost made the Final Four under Tom Davis's first year, I believe it was his first year. This possibly could be his second, but I think it was his first. The first round was in Tucson, and my photographer and I traveled to Tucson way early because we wanted to get Iowa's team coming in to the airport,
backstory.
Right?
Yeah,
you know, you're like a groupie when you follow these people around because, oh, look, they're going into the bathroom. Was it number one or number two? You know, what do you think? No, just kidding on that, but you know what I mean.
Sure.
You feel like a groupie.
But you want the backstory, too.
Yeah,
you want
to humanize everything.
Right.
Yeah. So Chuck and I, we didn't realize that the plane was going to be landing on the tarmac way away from the terminal, that they were going to have people come out and get them and take them away. That was never communicated to us, or we never asked it. We'd never covered a team out on a tournament before. So we were standing at the gate. They were supposed to arrive because we knew the time they're arriving, and there they are out on the tarmac. They're starting to come out of the plane, and we're standing right by an exit door. Do not open. Alarms will sound. I looked at Chuck. Chuck looked at me, and I said, I'll take full responsibility. And we busted down the fire escape thing out. Immediately, sirens blaring. We go out on the tarmac. We get the interview with Tom Davis. We get the interview with a couple of players real quick. While I'm doing the interview, I see the police.
Here come the police cars.
Police swarming in around us, and I'm just like, la, la, la. I may have mentioned to Coach Davis, I think we kind of went down a bad exit. But as I said, I apologized to everybody, and we had to get the story. And then subsequent to that story, or that time, we went back to the university's campus, Arizona's campus, and we had to find the place where we had already prearranged that they were just going to shove in the raw tape and send it back to the station so they could edit it back there. Well, heck, we couldn't find this building. We couldn't find it. We looked and looked, and we had a lot of time, and we were running out of time, and finally we found it. And it was just this, like, little
nondescript television thing.
Yeah, just lucked out. When we got back from that round, because we had to leave shortly after that, we went to Seattle because Iowa went on to play. They played UNLV in the last game, and Oklahoma. They played Oklahoma and UNLV. I got in trouble, of course, from my general man. Not really in trouble, but I was... What happened? Explain it to me. And what I had to do was write an apology to the airport head at Tucson for doing this. And I just said I didn't know what to do. I mean, I'm thinking all this money they were spending on our trip. But the good thing was I learned a lesson. So before we went to Seattle, I called the airport guy.
How are these people doing this?
Told them about, you know, where are they going to land, everything. And when we arrived, we got escorted out to the plane with airport officials, had a great interview, and then we got to go to this kick-ass party, too. But, I mean, it was just this, you learned on the fly.
And so you were no longer a criminal when you were in
Seattle. No, I was not a criminal. But wow. It was that's just those types of things happened a lot where you just had to make a call. Am I going to do it? Am I not going to do it? I might be able to get away with it because I'm a woman. I mean,
you know,
frankly,
there is that old saying that says,
I'm so sorry.
Well, it's easier to say I'm sorry than ask for permission.
Oh, for sure.
And
for
how many
sure.
times have you done that? A bunch, I'll bet.
I can't answer that and be honest about it, so I won't answer it.
I think we all, you know, those of us who have been doing media for a long time, we just intrinsically know sometimes you have to break the rules to get whatever the story is, because that's what we do. You know, that's what you do. And, it's a great story. Let's go back a ways, because you have a fascinating story about your mother. And you were a swimmer in school, and you dreamt of going to the Olympics. And you kind of sort of got there, but it
wasn't swimming. I daydream about it because if you have a certain amount of success when you're young, you know, you're always, the Olympics. So my mom supported me, of course, and she was a delegate to the AAU National Convention from the state of Iowa. And at the time, in a lot of sports, when the United States wasn't proficient and they were trying to develop sports, one of these sports was luge. My mom was at the luge meeting. That's the one-man sled. They have a two-man luge, too, but just a sled going downhill, feet first on your back. If you go down the hill...
What could go wrong?
If you go down the... I don't know if they still have this in the Olympics, but they also had Cresta, which is similar sled to a luge sled, but you went down just like you would on a when you were a kid sliding on your stomach face first. So, anyway, my mom... A friend of hers from another delegation said, would your daughter think she'd be interested in doing this, the one that swims? Because people knew who their kids were. You get to know the people in your region.
Sure.
And she came back and asked me if I wanted to go luge and, you know, train for the Olympic luge team. And I'm
like, how old are you?
I'm 16. I've never been out of the Midwest. I've never been on a plane. I don't know what luge is. I don't mind being outside in the winter, but... You know, so anyway, I did go over there. I trained for about, I can't remember, 4 to 6 weeks in Hammarstrand, Sweden, and Königssee, West Germany. I was there for the World Championships. I did not compete because, frankly, I hadn't made that many runs down the sled. But these sleds were super heavy. They're nothing like they are now. They probably weighed 60 pounds. They had this metal bar that held the canvas seat. It would just... We had to carry the sleds up the mountain before we went down. We had to shovel the runs on the mountain because it was snowing up there like you wouldn't believe. I mean, come on.
Yeah, and you're the swimmer.
Yeah, where's the pool? Yeah. I did go swimming in a pool in Germany. I remember that. But it was quite an experience.
I can't say
that I'd recommend it to you. Anyone.
And this is in what year?
1970.
Okay, so 1970. And of course, the whole luge group that you went with were from all over the world?
I mean, well, they were Americans, but there was a girl from California who was 19. She was the only one of the ones that traveled from New York. We converged in New York and flew over to... We flew to Munich, and then we took a bus up to Hammarstrand. She had done it before.
She had luged before.
But the other people that came, they were like me. There was a dude who was like maybe 25, 30, who was a race car driver from Geneseo, Illinois. There was a basketball player, from a woman from, I think, California. I kind of remember their names. I don't know. But the guy that was our manager was some engineer from Kodak, Eastman Kodak. He lived in Rochester, New York, and he just loved luge. And these people were the ones that were the driving force behind getting the Olympics in Lake Placid in 1980, if you remember that, Miracle on Ice stuff. But it was just a collection of people that...
Ragtag.
But then when we went to Europe, we rendezvoused with some members of the U.S. Air Force, I believe just the Air Force, but military guys who were stationed over there, because those in large part were the ones that represented the United States in the Olympics in like 64 and 68. And then the 72 Olympics were in Sapporo, Japan. And then 76 was in Innsbruck.
And while you were there in Europe training for the U.S. Olympic team, I think this is just amazing.
Whee!
I mean, who in the world... A woman from Iowa, ladies and gentlemen, goes crashing down these slopes. You were there when some tragedy struck at the same time.
So the World Championships were held at Königssee, which was a real modern refrigerated track, and the U.S. had nothing like that in its country. The track at Lake Placid was really old and stuff because I think it was from the 50s. Because I think the Olympics, I think maybe the 54 Olympics were in Lake Placid. But this was a fast track, and people were coming to train for the World Championships. And there was a team, from a two-man team, luge from Italy, which had crashed and gone over the track, going over the safety fence that was up on the last curve to the end of the straightaway at the end. And they were killed.
Oh, my.
And they had a funeral for them. And I was asked if I wanted to represent the U.S. at this funeral. And I'm like, can I not? You know, I mean, I was just, if you were there and you knew what was going on this whole time, there was a lot of other things that were going on. I was just not wanting to go, and I didn't know who I'd be going with or what. I didn't want to go. And I felt kind of bad. I felt like I should, but I decided that this one time I scrote it up and said, no, I did not want to go to that. I thought they should send someone else. I had a feeling that they didn't want to send somebody who was really good on the U.S.
team because,
you know, they'd miss out on some practice time, and they really didn't practice that much.
All right, this is the national. And what happened to Heidi Soliday, the luge
Well, after it was over, you know, I was really glad to get home. And then I got a letter from, it was probably from this Fred Hushla, that said, congratulations, you've been named to the U.S. Olympic luge team. And they were sending two women and I think three men. Unfortunately, though, they could only pay for one woman and two men. So if I wanted to go, I'd have to pay my way. And, you know, I thought about it a little bit, and I thought about who had sponsored me to get to go to train, Mid-Continent Bottlers of Des Moines. And I decided, I didn't really want to, because the experience of that was so different in just the whole scope of it, the training, the camaraderie, what you wore, what you did. To me, it wasn't a sport like swimming where you're working out really hard and you're using your whole body. It was more like a racing thing, like cars. And I mean, it was just so foreign to what I interpreted as a sport that I wasn't into it at all. And maybe now I would be. I used to say back when I was in my 40s, oh, well, you know, maybe I would have tried it now, but nah. I mean, I never really rude the day that I decided, no, I don't. And I would have had to get my own money to go.
But Sapporo, Japan, as an Olympic athlete, that would have been kind of cool.
That would have been kind of cool, but I would have... Sorry, can I be irreverent here?
Sure, go ahead.
I would have sucked, man.
Not really.
I mean, seriously, it would have just been... Do you remember Eddie the Eagle?
Yeah.
The jumper? I mean, that would have been me. Eddie the Eagle, the person everybody was laughing at because she couldn't make a run down the Sapporo track.
Oh, my gosh. Heidi Soliday, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I didn't know any of these stories before we sat down and started to talk. And this is just incredible stuff. I mean,
I know a lot more than I don't think I could say.
I bet. All right. So the natural follow up to that story
is why?
What the hell are you thinking about? is how did that experience create in you any other than the desire not to luge ever again? Did that experience ever start to mold you in the whole interest level of reporting on sports rather than being part of those sports?
I've always wanted to cover the Olympics. That would have been something I could have said earlier, too, is to be a reporter at the Olympics would be very fun. But I always appreciated that human dynamic of training for something, working out as hard as you can to try and see as good as you can be. And that's why I think the Olympics was always sort of something I liked to pay attention to, because there's so many great stories out of that. So many. And I've been to one Olympics.
Yeah.
And that was the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. We were a part of the Bruce Jenner contingent because Bruce was my husband's roommate in college. He was best man in my wedding. And my husband was best man in his first wedding to Christy. So when Bruce was starting out as his career, I was privy to some information about him, and I knew about this guy, and I followed track a little bit. So I'd heard of this guy named Bruce Jenner, who went to Grayson College, who got 10th at the Munich Olympics. And because he'd gotten 10th, that was an eye-opener. It was like, you can't really do that well in the Olympics and not have some potential. And the man who coached him at Graceland in track, L.D. Weldon, had coached a couple of other Olympians in the decathlon. I think I misspoke earlier. I said triathlon. I meant decathlon earlier. And I believe one of these guys had received the bronze medal possibly in the 30s in the decathlon or sometime around in there. But LD could tell that Bruce had the capability of being a really good athlete. So when I went to those Olympics to watch, and I knew all these people were there, like I saw Joe Corso, a Valley High School grad, wrestle, and I saw water polo games, and I saw Alberto Wantorena. He was, I think, an 800-meter runner. I saw a lot of great things there, and I would have loved to have been able to do stories on these.
Yeah. As we talk about those stories that you've done over the years, Heidi Soliday, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest. We're out to lunch at the Range Grill and Golf in Urbandale, as a matter of fact. And this is a beautiful facility, by the way, so if you get out this way, you just got to check
it out.
Makes
me want to golf.
Yeah, it does, you know, even though we have decent weather. When you talk about interesting stories that you've done over the years, what stands out? There's got to be one or two stories out there that we were just sitting here and you were commenting.
Well, I feel badly bringing this up because I can't remember this gentleman's name, but this was one story that really touched me. And this was a gentleman who worked at Buena Vista College. He was their sports information director. And he'd gotten muscular dystrophy, and he was still doing his job, sending out the info about all these sports up there, even while he was losing
his dexterity,
yeah, right. his capability right. of moving his arms and legs. He did it. I think he had a blow thing, or he dictated into a computer. And I remember doing a story on him, and he passed away not too terribly long after we did the story. And that was a really good story. I mean, sometimes you'd meet people and you just want to be their friend, right? Or know them or tell them you empathize with them. That's one thing about being a reporter is I think you're supposed to kind of keep a barrier between yourself and what you're covering. And I always felt like, I don't know, I kind of want to know this person more. And then, of course, there's stories that you did that you just thought the person you were covering was a jerk, right?
No.
Get away from me. Ick. You stink.
Yeah, yeah. And there
and
are
you still
got to
be like their big bud,
right?
Because you might not get that story.
Right,
so.
Right.
But there's so many really good stories. I remember, well, just like one thing I had a lot of fun with was soul searching is what I called it. But Seoul was spelled like Seoul, Korea.
Oh, okay.
Because the Olympics were coming up. Mm-hmm. So over the course of the summer before the Olympics, I just hunted to find all these stories that had some kind of a connection to Iowa and the Olympics. Like there was a kayaker up in northeastern Iowa that had a shot at going, or I don't know if they ever made it, but they were one of the ones they were looking at. There was a former baseball assistant coach at Iowa, or actually he may have been at the time, but he was going to be the Olympic baseball coach for Sweden. There was a swimmer who had swum at the University of Iowa who was on Britain's team. John Davy is his name, and he actually has three children that swim now here in Des Moines. Jillian is the oldest. She is a fantastic breaststroker, a really good swimmer. So his kids all swim, and Davy went on to coach at the University of Iowa. Just all sorts of, there's track people.
Interesting connections.
Yes, yes. So that's always cool. I always am rooting for those ones that come from Des Moines or Iowa that do really well in any kind of a world stage with athletics, because I know how, if you've ever competed even at a small level, say in high school, and the work you have to put in to be sort of good in high school, and you imagine taking that intensity and trying to be as good in an Olympics, and there's kids that compete in high school or even in college that they're really, really good. They kick butt wherever they compete, but then they get to the college level or they try to go
right
beyond that, and they're just another of hundreds that are that good.
Exactly, because the level when you at high school is a whole different thing. Then you get to college.
And that's a whole different thing.
That's a whole different thing. And then even to ascend into the pros, if you're so lucky. I mean, the percentage of
is
people.
It's so teeny.
Yeah.
You always hear about the how many athletes want to make like the NBA. And the percentage of basketball players that can make it in the NBA is like so much smaller than becoming a CEO of a Fortune 500 company.
Yeah.
That you're like, you're going to expend probably the same or more amount of mental and physical energy to get that job. Why wouldn't you want to go to the job that you have better odds at getting than trying, you know? So it's something about sports, the glorification of it.
It might be.
People don't glorify necessarily a CEO of a company, but man, you can't beat 25,000 people cheering your name when you step out on a basketball court, right?
Heidi Soliday is our guest. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out to lunch at the Range Grill and Golf.
We're salivating right
now. We are salivating. Where's
Michelle?
We need Michelle, quick.
Garçon, feet.
We got to be ordering here something. Okay, where am I going to go? Can you tell we're kind of freestyling this?
Yeah, we're free soloing.
Free soloing, that's right. Wow. Famous people.
Famous people.
Because you started down this path, and we were just watching a Tube interview with Tiger Woods, as a matter of fact, which was kind of interesting. He's obviously, like the rest of us, he's aging, and he's still playing the game.
You want me to tell you some cool sports people stories?
Yeah, just.
Well, I have a couple from the Masters, because that's what we're watching. The Masters starts up, I think. Tomorrow's the par 3 tournament, because tomorrow's Wednesday, right? So in 1987, I got to go cover the Masters. I mean, I had a choice to just go and watch or go and cover, and I brought my husband with me because he's a golf freak, and so I went and covered it, and I won man-banded.
So you were there, huh?
Totally.
You know what? You said Michelle, and
here
look
she
who
is.
Shows up.
Wow.
Yay, hey.
So does that mean we got to curb our little chat
we're
about
gonna,
the
we're
Masters?
We're
going to
come back with the Masters story and all that stuff. Hi, Michelle. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you for showing up. We were just about to fall over because we hadn't ordered yet.
No, you haven't. I'm wondering when it's going to happen, but here I am.
All right. Heidi, you're going to do what? What are you?
I'm doing that. Is it the Southwest salad? Only I'm opting for the boring chicken over the chilled shrimp.
Okay.
And
right.
I hear it's really spicy. You told me that.
Yeah.
How spicy is it? Am I going to feel it later, Michelle?
You won't feel it later, but you'll feel it while you're eating it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not too bad.
I love it. All right.
Yeah.
Well, I am going to do the Southwest salad as well, but not chicken. We're going to do the salmon.
The salmon. Okay. That's a good choice. And you both want the sauce on it, correct?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Go for
Kill
the
us.
Sauce. Yeah.
Okay.
Do it. Well, so how long have you been here, Michelle?
I have been here either October, I believe it's October, so a few months.
What do you like best about the Range Grill and Golf?
I love making, like, we have a lot of unique cocktails, and I really, really enjoy that. It's very different from other bars that I've worked at. So, yeah, I enjoy the really fun cocktails and concoctions that we create.
What's the, name a couple that you really, that's like your forte?
Ooh, okay. Let's see.
What's one that's gonna make me forget my name?
Oh my goodness! Probably Ace in the Hole. It has tequila.
Ace in the Hole. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's in that?
We infuse tequila with different berries.
Gotta like it.
And then we have like Cointreau, some little bit of simple, if depending on the bartender is. I put a little bit of simple to add a little bit of sweetness. Some sour mix. It's lovely. Salted rims.
Sounds great. Lovely.
Yeah.
And anything with tequila will make you lose your memory.
Really? It also helps you lose weight because don't they call, like, just tequila and lime juice? That's like a diet margarita?
Yeah.
Sort of?
So, yeah.
Skinny margarita?
Skinny margarita, yeah. That's what a lot of people like.
So yours is a sort of a skinny Ace in the Hole, right?
Kind
as long as you don't add a lot of sugar
in
it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you count the berries with a little bit of sugar, but no, it's great.
You're
it's
supposed
really good.
To eat fruit.
That's true.
All right, so we got onto the liquor thing right away, Heidi. That was kind of fun. What about the food side? So we're doing the Southwest Chicken Salad. This is very safe because we are both safe today.
Yeah.
But if we were going to blow it out of the water, all right, and come back maybe for dinner or something, what would you recommend that we had other than a couple dozen of those tequila sour things or whatever that is?
Well, my favorite thing on the menu, hands down, is our bison burgers. So depending, we have like bison tenderloin, we have elk even on the menu. But my favorite, hands down, is the bison burgers. They're just really tender, super great. I don't know too many places in town where you can get bison. So that's what I like a lot.
Well, I'm not sure which route I'm going as we drive out to Glacier when I do that climate ride later. But I know in North Dakota they serve a lot of bison up there. I've never had a bison burger before.
It's delicious. It's not too gamey.
Not too gamey?
Yeah, it's delicious.
Have you had bison?
I have not, but I was talking to the owner just yesterday, Steve, and Steve was talking about they have elk and bison, and he said both of those, if you do the steak thing, are tender and moist and yummy and really good, unlike some things in the beef category. But
right.
We don't want to piss off our local Iowa
beef producers. No, way, way to go.
Yeah, all right. Sorry. we've been asked to leave the state.
And this has been out.
Yeah, this is the Sia. We're now in Calgary. Michelle, thank you so much. You're a beautiful young woman. Do you have a family?
Yes, I have a husband, recently married. We have a very cute dog.
Aww.
And yeah,
what's the dog's name?
His name is Howard.
Howard, that's
like,
great.
Yeah, so I'm from Minnesota. He's from North Dakota. We went to school in North Dakota. So
ooh,
that's where our families
Fargo?
Live. No, not Fargo. We're at Grand Forks,
is
North Dakota.
Is that North Dakota State then?
Fargo is North Dakota State.
Okay.
I'm the University of North Dakota,
okay.
Fighting Sioux. Forever.
Fighting
that's
Sioux.
Good.
Fighting Sioux
the
forever.
Fighting Sioux, yeah.
See what we learn, what we pick up here.
Well, that's
good stuff.
Of course we did.
All right. Thanks, Michelle. All right. We will have to have a photograph of Michelle.
Oh, yeah.
Simply because she is so adorable.
Yeah, she was very, she's very, very welcoming. Very
yeah.
welcoming.
Yeah.
That's nice.
We kind of like that. All right. Famous people.
Okay. So we were talking about the Masters. So in 87, went there. That's your Larry Mize, Greg Norman, and Seve Ballesteros, the dashing
ooh.
Spaniard,
yeah.
had a playoff. And I was one man banning it. I came here. I always look for more than one story to do. And the club pro at Augusta National was a man by the name of, I hope I'm getting this right, Dave Spencer. He was from Perry, Iowa. I'm pretty sure of this, but I didn't like study before I got here. Anyway, I was doing a story on this Iowan that was the club pro at Augusta, arguably one of the most famous golf courses in the world, right? And to get in, I had a tripod and a camera and all this stuff. And as I approached the clubhouse to go in to go see Dave, who's walking about the same time? Seve, the dashing Spaniard.
The dashing Spaniard.
He opened the door for me. And I walked in, and he slammed the door in front of my husband. My husband keeps saying, yeah, I remember that. He shut the door in my face. But anyway, we walked through and I did the interview with Dave Spencer, and that was one of the features I did as a result of going to the Masters. But that was a great playoff. Seve got knocked out.
Greg Norman won, didn't he?
No, it was actually Larry Mize, because he really? Hit a shot that hit a stick, you know, in the hole, and it caromed off. I think that's what it was and went in. Or it might have just bounced crazy and went in. But he won on the third hole of the playoff. And I'm not sure if Greg Norman ever won the Masters.
Huh. Okay.
I'm not sure.
But he does. He's a very memorable character.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and Larry Mize was from the Augusta area. That's why that was kind of
nice.
Cool. But I even have a picture of Larry Mize is in my husband, and Larry Mize is in the background on the putting green before he won. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But we followed the par three tournament. So famous people there. I've you know, every once in a while I've gotten autographs. That's kind of a faux pas when you're covering something.
Sure. Right.
And I've never really done it in a situation that's a high pressure thing or one. But if it's some kind of charity game or. It's 2, 3, 4 days before an event and it's just a media thing, I would think nothing of just handing something to get an autograph. But I remember a few years back, John Walters and I were going to cover in Iowa City a Bulls Bullets exhibition game, and Michael Jordan was there, and because of B.J. Armstrong, and John's from the Chicago area, and he, of course, is the Iowa State play-by-play guy. And we got there early, and he wanted to get an autograph of Michael Jordan. And I'm like, oh, I'll ask him. I had brought up a magazine just in case, right? And he goes, oh, no, I don't have anything to sign. And I go, well, let's go look. We walked around Iowa City. We went to the Penny's in Iowa City, and he got a Bulls hat there. And so we were just waiting. We were way ahead of the event. We'd already done all the interviews. It's an exhibition game. It means nothing, right? And so when Jordan came out of the locker room and walking down the hall, I said, hey, could you sign a couple things? And he did. And so John got this autograph.
Nice. Back.
But the thing is, I mean, I know it's frowned upon a little bit. I don't know if I would do it now, but I was pretty good about not doing it in situations where it was really horrible.
Well,
you know?
I think, you know, today, one of the things that we have to watch out for, and I'm always conscious of this, and I, we don't do politics on the Business News Hour, but I have had the opportunity to really sit down and interview a large number of the current political crop that are seeking election in 2020. Mm-hmm. And I always would, you know, I'm halfway tempted to do the selfie. You know, with Kamala Harris or Beto O'Rourke or whomever it happens to be.
But you just don't?
But I don't.
But you know, people do that now. I've noticed more and more where people are out and about, and maybe they're a little bit more low-key type people in the public eye, that maybe they're celebrities as well. But there's situations where people do that a lot, and I don't know. I mean, if the person's willing to do it, I suppose you could wait till after you're completely done with whatever you're doing, and then.
Well, I just feel funny. It makes me feel funny. You know, I
could see that. Yeah. I don't know if I would do that myself, unless you were seeing the person away. Like, say you're in a town or a city for a big event, and you're covering that big event, and maybe before the event or after the event, you're at a function that has nothing really to do with the event. And you run into this same person or somebody who is a big wig associate. You could do it then.
I may do it if it wasn't a political thing. And because we are so polarized in politics here in the United States that if I have, and I will tell you, I was in Boone, Iowa not long ago, and Cory Booker was there. And so I go up to Senator Booker and I said, my wife is a big fan. Do you mind if I get a photograph? And he goes, what's your wife's name? I said, Georgie. And he goes, give me your phone. So he hits the video. He says, hey, Georgie, it's Cory Booker. I'm up here with your amazing husband. I'm going, yeah. But that was kind of a different thing. I don't know. It's just.
But see, the thing is, you never know when that type of a thing
right.
is going to be something that will go viral. And whether it's for specifically for a political thing or for something, if it goes viral, then you get all that attention. And what's that saying? That there's no bad news? Publicity or no bad news.
Give me my 15 seconds, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Heidi Soliday is our guest. We are out to lunch at the Range Grill and Golf, a fabulous place in Urbandale, Iowa. So if you are a visitor to Iowa or the metro area and you like grills and you like golf, this is kind of the place to be. We were talking about the Masters and your trips around and all of the things, all of the people that you've seen. I want to fast forward just a little bit about the business, if I can, of getting stories. Today, it seems like news people are not so much directed to go do stories, but those story finds are really the responsibility of the reporter. In other words, yeah, you know that this is going on or that's going on, but really it's your responsibility to get that stuff. When you were doing this actively, did you have to check in with somebody before, let's say that they were doing whatever the sports story was? Did you have to get approval first through the news director or you were the sports director? The general manager?
Well, you know, in general, the stories that we would think up, those were the stories we did. I mean, there's going to be natural stories you cover. There's a big game coming up, Iowa State game or something like that, the Iowa Cubs home opener. You're going to cover that. Of course, with sports, there's two sides to it. There's the game itself, and then there's something that might be a peripheral story about it, or about maybe there's renovations to the ballpark, or maybe there's some new player, whatever. There's always other stories besides the actual game. But in general, anything that we would come up with, that would be the story that you do, because you had story meetings and you'd plug stuff. But most of the time, if the story was able to be done, hell yeah, it got done. There were times, I'm sure, I can't really think of anything off the top of my head, where a story was suggested to do, but no, we thought up our stories anyway. I remember one thing I did that I really got tired of doing after a while. It was just a franchise thing, the Soliday Sports Challenge. And the reason I got tired of doing it was it always seemed to be, it was just like one of those sort of fun-loving but kind of nothing stories that make people laugh but aren't necessarily that big of a deal. Like, you know, somebody challenging me to jump rope with them or something like that. And I don't know, I got kind of tired of doing that. Those are very valuable. Franchise pieces are good because you become recognizable.
It humanizes.
An example of a really excellent franchise on a national level would be like Steve Hartman's pieces on CBS Sunday Morning or something like that. But, you know, you can have fun with those. And I try to have fun with them over the years, but I kind of got tired. Now, those were something that I was encouraged to do. I didn't think that up. Somebody else thought up that. And so that would be, you know, the someone else thinking up the story.
Would you define yourself as a serious journalist?
Well, I guess, yes, I would, in the sense that if I'm going to do something, and I'm going to do it as well as I can, I'm going to give it my all, I'm not going to try and mail it in, and so I'm going to be serious about it. That doesn't mean the story is going to be serious, but if I'm going to use a sense of that
totally
word,
understand.
That yes, I would consider that. I did lots of stories that were more serious than not, and I tried to get a lot of bang out of my personal talent buck, I guess. For example, one year Iowa was playing at the University of Hawaii. They were ranked number one in the country on a couple of preseason polls, and so I convinced the powers that be that a trip to Hawaii would be okay.
There you go.
If the tickets were fairly cheap, and if I hired a freelance photographer at a certain rate, and I hired one guy, two half days, he covered the football game itself. But then I did some research, and the U.S. diving trials were going to be at the University of Hawaii. There was a lot of swimmers that were there that I recognized just walking around at this mall. So what I did was I did an interview with the Hawaii athletic director, who was Stan Sheriff. Stan Sheriff was a football coach at the University of Northern Iowa. And the Stan Sheriff Field, see? And then he was the AD there, and then he took the job at Hawaii. So I did an interview with him, you know, updating. And
sure.
I think he was an Iowa guy. I did a deal on the Olympic facilities that were at the university. Also, the Ironman triathlon was just getting going. And there were a couple of athletes from Iowa, including an attorney in Des Moines. His name is Greg Brown, and he was very good in the Ironman, and he was one of the first ones to do that around here, and he was going to be competing in it. So I talked to the director of the Ironman triathlon, and I took a little video, you know, beauty shots, and then when I got back, I could do a story with Greg, and because it was coming up, and he competed in it. So in other words, this trip that didn't cost that much.
You got a lot of stuff
I got a lot of stories out of it. Plus the game stories, too, which, of course, Iowa ended up losing. There was a running back named Hakoti Fakava. And as any Iowa football fans know, a lot of times there's a game that you might think Iowa's going to win, and then some player will just rise up and have a hell of a game, and this guy did. He was hard to stop, and Hawaii ended up winning in a close game, something like, I don't know, 17-13 or something. I don't know what it was. But it was a close game, and Iowa lost. So they started out this season where a lot of people picked them to be a national champ.
And here we go to Hawaii, and you figure this is a slam dunk. And yeah,
there was a hurricane off the coast of Hawaii. Near. It was near. And so I remember one of my lines in my post-game story was that everybody had been worried about hurricane whatever it was, but it was Hurricane Fakava that
sealed the deal.
Yeah.
Well, how is it, and I know we all have passions about various things, how is it that many sports people that I talk to, and I'm not a sports guy, I enjoy watching
it. Ride bikes, dude.
Yeah, I know, but there's, all right. But
do you golf?
No.
I don't golf.
I don't do anything other than
weeks?
This. No, I don't do that. How is it that you're able to ingest and keep those scores, especially in those names of these people that may only shine for a very brief year or two, but you still recall those scores and those stories?
Interesting question, because I've thought about some aspects of that before, and I've talked with my husband about it. I've always had an affinity for being able to remember times and statistics, sort of. Probably because when I was swimming, I was always thinking about my splits and my time and who got this time and who got that time. So I just always, I mean, I can remember times, or I still look at swimming results for kids around here, or people I know that might be swimming somewhere, just a meet that's coming up that might be kind of fun to watch. So I think that when you're able to do that, when you remember names or games or statistics, it's because you were extremely interested in them at the time. I read a lot about sports, not constantly. I don't even really watch sports that much. I watch some things a lot, but not necessarily, but I do read. And so many times I've tried to read articles about, say, a hockey game or a baseball game or maybe a sport that I don't really follow a lot. And if it's just about the game or maybe some kind of innocuous thing about the game, I can't follow it. I can't even remember what a paragraph said. But if it's a really interesting backstory or something, I'll remember it a heck of a lot more, and that is probably because I didn't really follow hockey. I've read a lot of great hockey stories, but I don't really go to hockey games. I don't really like boxing. I've
Do you understand wrestling?
I understand wrestling, and if I know someone wrestling, I'll watch wrestling. But and I'm not talking about that WWE.
No. High school, college wrestling. I don't get it.
Well,
there's a lot.
There's so many fine tunes, and I think actually wrestling has got to be one of the hardest sports there is. I mean, there's nothing harder than mano a mano and trying to find out who's the best. You got to be so tough in that. And boxing is like that too. Maybe it's just the physical violence aspect of the boxing.
The other thing, wrestlers and making weight and all of those things, that is craziness.
It's so ridiculous. I have a friend whose son played football for a very competitive and talented high school, and he also wrestled. For football, he had to gain, like, I don't know. Right, he put on a ton of weight. Right as soon as the football season ends, he's going to wrestle, but the weight he would wrestle at is the same weight as this guy that's probably going to win state or something. So he's got to drop weight to be competitive and, you know, be able to wrestle for varsity. So he's got to lose, like, 30 pounds in a short amount of time. That's insane.
It's nuts. All right. Hey, Michelle's here.
Ciao.
Michelle. Yay, Michelle.
Oh, look at this.
I'm back.
And just in time, too. Chicken is Heidi.
Thank you.
Oh, look at that. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. This looks
Bye.
Amazing. Oh, my. And we have silverware and everything here. Wow. And it's artistically put together. So obviously we have to have photograph, and got to do that. Got to have the food in the thing. So anyway, let's eat. We are at the Range Grill and Golf. Good stuff, huh?
Very good.
You had the chicken and the
Southwest salad with the chicken, very spicy.
Michelle said it was spicy.
It was.
It was.
She
yeah.
Didn't lie.
No lie from
but with
Michelle.
With a face like that, she can't lie.
No, she isn't. She just adorable.
She was very cute, and she was telling us about her little doggy Howard.
Yeah. Howard the dog. The stuff that we get in on, you know, it's just too much fun. So while we were eating this wonderful lunch, you and I were talking a lot about the biz. And I was kind of reflecting on the fact that you've been out of the newsroom now for 11 years. Do you miss it?
There's aspects that I would say I enjoyed at the time. Do I miss it? I don't know as I ever really missed it. Like, oh, gosh. Someone once said to me, there's life after television. Sent me a note who had actually worked where I worked for quite a while as well, and I can appreciate that because there is. I mean, there's so much other stuff going on. And I guess I do find it at times that just because you're on television, just because you do something where people see you, why does that oftentimes seem to be a really, really, really important job more so than a lot of other jobs? And it's just that innate thing about humans maybe that you want to get attention. You want to be noticed. And so if you have a job like that, people are envious of that, or people can be very cruel about that or criticize how you look and everything because they want that position.
Right.
But in reality, just because you're on TV, I mean, that what is that really worth? I mean, you could take your job seriously. You asked if I was a serious journalist or... But that doesn't mean that that job is any big deal compared to, you know, running a city or working at a bank or looking after the monies of someone as a, like a stockbroker or something. You're looking after somebody or a doctor or a teacher. I mean, there's a gazillion jobs that really should be much more revered than somebody who just sits down 3 or 4 times a day and reads a script on camera. It's that camera thing, you know.
It's the camera thing.
It's a camera
thing. It's all the media thing. And, you know, I get it because there is a certain notoriety with that. There's a certain publicness of that.
It could sure make you seem like you're something else,
right? Absolutely.
But in reality, if that's really what you're thinking, you're pretty shallow.
Yeah. Well, I think there is a great responsibility with the media. And I think that that's, look, we can be doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, teachers. There's still great responsibility with that. But it's not as public a responsibility. And I think that maybe is a differentiator, that that if you are in that business and in that job, there's an extra sense of accountability, maybe. I don't, you know, because it's so public.
It's accountability for sure, but on the same hand, you got your people watching out for what you do, that you people you work for that can dictate things about what you do because you don't want to lose dollars or whatever, right? So, I mean, it's kind of a strange job in a way. It really is. If you take away the reporting aspect where you're getting a story and you want to write the story as true as it is and all that, and you want to tell people about something that's very important. But I guess maybe it's just the anchoring aspect that's really nothing. Because you can read a story.
You can read a script, yeah.
You don't have to hear somebody tell it to you. And just the fact that somebody has a good voice or they're attractive and they're reading you a story elevates them in a lot of people's esteem. And that's really kind of ridiculous.
Interesting. Heidi Soliday is our guest. We're out to lunch at the Range Grill and Golf. How much does passion play as part of being with a news team? I mean, there's a certain camaraderie and everybody knows everybody and you're all working in close proximity with each other. But how important is having passion for the job?
I would say that it's probably super important to be able to continue doing something for years and years and years and do it well. But the reality is that at a lot of places, media places, whether it's radio or maybe it's a newspaper, maybe it's a television station, there's always going to be competition.
Yep.
Somebody who's got the big main job is going to be a target for someone that wants that big main job. And so I believe that even though there could be passion about what you're offering, which you should have if you're in a job that you like, etc., you still got to watch out for all the people that are out there looking for your job. And so many things can affect that, you know, just life.
Yeah.
Life can affect what happens and how people look at you.
And not to belabor the subject, but I think that as we look at the world of broadcast journalism, especially in the television era, there are some expectations on females that may not necessarily be the same as men. I believe that, and just this is just watching and being part of this whole thing, where men can stay in the broadcasting light for a long time.
That's just, I think it has to do with the visual thing for sure, just like in acting. Older women don't often have a lot of roles in television or movies. You don't see a whole lot of older women in television for news or reporting. Just think about the shows you watch as far as news shows or, I guess, even sports shows. And you think about the age or the apparent age, according to what you see.
Right.
How many look kind of old that are women and how many that look kind of old that are men? And there's going to be a big disparity in that for sure. But on Netflix now, no, what I was going to say was I was hearing something. It was an actress who, her name's escaping me right now, but she's in a movie coming up on Netflix, and she was saying how there are so many roles, not only for older women, but for everybody on these streaming sites, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, etc., because they got to fill the time, and they have all these shows constantly, all these
individuals. So there's possibilities.
There's tons of roles available, so that might be a positive for
those of us who are aging?
For those of us out there that are older than 50 and younger than 80.
There you go. Heidi Soliday. She's here all week, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget to...
Unfortunately for you.
Tip the wait staff. All right. What have you been doing? You're into this cycling thing.
Okay. So I've been... I always biked. I biked in college. I didn't have my driver's license till I was 20, I think, 19 or 20. So I bike a lot. I after I swam, I still swam Masters for a while, and then I went to swimming and running, and then this triathlon thing started, so swimming, running, biking. And then those are hard, so maybe you don't want to do those all the time, but you can just bike, which cycling is a really easy exercise to do. So I've done a lot of biking, and in the last, this July, I'm doing my third Climate Ride. And Climate Ride is a nonprofit organization that's been in existence for 11 years where they get people to raise a certain amount of money, and that certain amount of money raised, they get to pick their own nonprofit to donate. But Climate Ride provides the leadership on the event, food on the event. Most of these events, people camp. You have to pay your own way to get there. So the vast majority of the money you raise does go to your nonprofit. And there's some events where Climate Ride picks the nonprofit. So what I'm doing is the Glacier Ride in July. And so the Glacier National Park Conservancy is receiving all the money from the 50 people that will be doing this event. But it's really cool because I've raised money for the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation and the Iowa Bicycle Coalition, but all the nonprofits that you can see, and you can go to their website, climateride.org, to just see the list of the nonprofit organizations that have been helped. But this year they've added a couple of things that are kind of cool. I wouldn't do them, but one's called the Rogue River Run, and they've got a group of people that are running in the Rogue River Valley in Oregon, and they're running 10 to 15 miles a day. If they get tired, maybe they can canoe for a while, but I think it's a 3 or 4 day event. And they're also doing a thing at, is it Bear Eagle Pass? Bear? It's a, in 2016, it was established as a national monument.
Okay.
And a lot of times, those eventually become national parks. Bear Eagles Pass, and recently the 1.3 million acres that were established as the land, that was rescinded by the current government, so now it's the acreage is down 85%, and it's also being endangered by mining and oil, and so that's a big thing going on, so they're doing an event there to try and get people fired up about protecting that. And there's currently some guys doing some crazy things across country for Climate Ride. One guy's riding from San Francisco to Boston in 8 days.
What?
Yeah, he's averaging 155 miles a day. That's his own personal thing he developed. He's done several Climate Ride events. And then there's another gentleman who's riding across country, and he's doing 90 talks in 90 days. About Climate Ride and how people can help, because they promote, what they're promoting obviously is trying to counteract climate change, going green, eliminating carbon emissions, things like that. And it's amazing some of the things that people are doing, because every little bit helps. Amazing. Even trying to influence voting down the road, you know, when you find out when there's a federal shutdown partial and a lot of the national parks don't have anything, they're not funded, and then what happens in those parks when people just come and do whatever,
right?
Those are precious commodities for the United States and the people that live here,
and to have those trashed like
exactly,
that
to have them trashed, you don't want that happening. And so I would just say, if you're interested in learning about that, go to climateride.org,
and we will have a link up there on our radio blog.
Maybe
course.
They'll link you to my fundraising
page. We'll probably even do that. Heidi, why not?
Maybe. You know? But there's a lot of cycling opportunities you could do, and you don't have to do anything to raise money. You can do the Baccoon Ride coming up in June here around town, and there's a Pigtail Ride. And you were telling me you ride a lot, don't you? Where do you usually ride when you go on?
Just the trails.
Yeah?
Just the trails.
What's your favorite trail?
I love going down to Cumming, Iowa.
Isn't that the great?
Yeah, it is just a great, it's a neat trip. You get down there and you meet all these friends Tuesday nights, you know.
Yeah.
It used to be the night that you'd go down there and hang out for a while and then pack it back. And the trail system, I think, is just remarkable. As a matter of fact, wherever I travel and we get into talking about cycling, and people say, well, are there places? We've got like 700 miles of trails in the greater Des Moines metro. And people go, really?
Mm.
It's unheard of.
I can't really think of a place that has more great trails close, except maybe up around in Minneapolis, they have tons of trails up there, and they split the pedestrians.
Through the lakes and
even in the city, it's really easy to get around there.
And that's another thing that's really taking hold, Heidi, is that many cities are now going to multimodal transportation opportunities like they've done in Europe for years and years and years. And bicycling and cycling can be centric to that.
Oh, yeah. You need healthy, active lifestyles for sure. And that's the way to go is if you can use those trails, you've got a bike. And, you know, you might want to get an e-bike.
You don't have
to pedal as much.
I was on one last year. Boy, was that cool.
Yeah, that could be the way to go.
Heidi Soliday, we have been out to lunch at the Range Grill and Golf out in Urbandale on Hickman Road. We'll have links, of course, on the radio blog for that. Thank you for doing this. This has been a lot of fun. You know, we have whiled away several hours here. And
Maybe it's wild for you, but it was wow for me. It was really fun. It was interesting to talk to whatever you can talk to somebody who's been around for a while and kind of knows some of the inroads like you do in a similar profession. You can get some great stories going there. So
it is some good, interesting stories all the time. Thanks again, Heidi.
Yep, thank you.
Once again, that was Heidi Soliday as we went out to lunch at the Range Grill and Golf in the greater Des Moines Metro. What a great bunch of stories. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed sitting for the 2.5 hours that we had together. It was fantastic. Thanks, Heidi. We really appreciate that. All right, we got to go. That about wraps it up for another edition of the Business News Hour Out to Lunch segment. For all of us associated with the Business News Hour, Chap Ramsey is our production coordinator. Sales and marketing falls to Aaron Libby. The voice of the Business News Hour is Hunter Pease. And the music you're listening to right now is arranged, composed, and conducted by our friend James Goodlett from Jam Good Productions. For all those folks, for Heidi Soliday, my name is Michael Libby. Have yourself a wonderful evening. Be safe, be well, be careful. Most of all, be good to your fellow man. Good day.